Hey everybody, welcome to the very first episode of the Yub Nub Club. This is Nikki Kumar of the Imperial Senate Podcast, but you probably already knew that. Up front, I want to say thank you for clicking on this and letting us help fill some time for you. We really appreciate it. But you know what? Let's get straight into why we're here. We got stuff to talk about. And joining me today is a master's student at SMU Guildhall. He's a co-producer on Asuria's Embers, the soon-to-be-released video game that he has worked on a team with and created from scratch. And most importantly, he's a good, long friend of myself. That sounded weird. A good, long-time friend of myself and the Imperial Senate Podcast. It's Mr. Reed Devaney. Welcome, my friend.
Hello, hello. It's a pleasure, as always, to join the Imperial Senate Podcast, and a flattering honor to be part of the early stages of the Yub Nub Club. So thank you for having me.
Absolutely. And yeah, we're just getting started with this little side project to help diversify the Imperial Senate feed, just, you know, explore other topics, not necessarily Star Wars ones, though, of course. We all love Star Wars, so it's never off limits. This is a cool episode because it's kind of like a little bit of a press tour, so to say. I know I was at your place the other weekend up in Dallas, and I managed to play actually. I think maybe earlier build of Asuria's Embers, this really epic game. It's a first person. I guess like archery adventure type of game. I'll let you, of course, describe it better. But I did get to play it, and when I played it, I thought, you know what, it'd be kind of cool to let the word get out and make sure that people know this game is gonna be on Steam, and that will actually be Wednesday, March 6th. So by the time you listen to this episode, it will have already been out. You can hang up now, stop the episode, and go download it and play it. I give you permission. We'll get into all that. And I guess first, I did want to talk to you, Reed, about, your journey into the video game world. We're like similar in that we kind of studied very similar things in undergrad. And of course, found that to be incredibly enriching, but we didn't exactly go on to pursue what you might expect from, our sort of labeled degrees. And we went into this creative field. So I wanted to just get what happened, as far as your personal feeling and why you felt like video games called to you at this point in your life.
Yeah, absolutely. So for those of you who don't know, I'll go ahead and divulge Nikki's background here too. So Nikki and I met in college doing Model UN together, but also we were history majors. And he and I have had this conversation on multiple occasions about how, like, as a history major, we're very grateful for that experience. But I think, Nikki, you can agree, like, we both realize what we loved about history is that second part of the world. It's the story element. And I know that that's like what drove you into writing. I was a little later to making that pivot necessarily, but I wanted to be involved in creative storytelling. And so I didn't come to games immediately. I worked in high performance computing, which kind of gave me an opportunity to work on the bleeding edge of technology. Mm-hmm. And I think it's my experience with technology that made me want to take my love of stories and merge that with tech, and really what is video games if not interactive technology. I mean, that's literally the name of the degree that they get you at SMU Guildhall, interactive technology, and, you know, sort of interactive storytelling, where you get to bring in the cool prowess of different game engines and programming and everything there. And so the reason I went with the route that I did in game development, which is production, is because what I realized I loved the most about working with teams is the people side of things. And I love enabling environments for creative people to flourish, for intelligent people to flourish. And that ultimately is what game production is. It's kind of a bloated phrase that oftentimes people have trouble defining. Production in the game space, it has its roots in like music production or radio production kind of, but there is elements of project management or being a producer like on a film set because budget is involved, all these different things. But it's kind of a catch-all term in the sense that you're sort of the team lead that is responsible for clearing blockers and making the space for a game to flourish. Mm-hmm. And for the team member behind that game to flourish. And so just working around talented people. And what I love about game development is it's so equitable if done correctly with the creative process. You know, it's not just like... ...trees out there, you know, where like, okay, you have a guy who's the writer, the director, the cinematographer, and the producer of a film. Uh-huh. It's very hard to have that in games, you know? So you have... Here's the programmers, here are the artists, here are the level designers. So being the producer, that kind of that linchpin to bring it all together and make that happen, to make those interesting stories come onto the screen in a field that what makes games the most unique form of entertainment is player agency.
Right.
You know? Like you watch a movie that happens to you.
Mm-hmm.
Or a TV show happens to you. A book happens to you. A game, you happen to it. And it's true, you know, there are a lot of games that are like, more of an experience than a game, or people laud it for being an experience, and that's totally fine. But there's still, it's like that underlying, like, I have the ability to control what's on the screen one way or the other within the set confines. I just loved that sandbox, and I wanted to get my hands into it. And, like, as for, like, another thing that influenced my journey, going back to, you know, how you and I first met, with ModelUN, that was kind of, like my first take on game design. So like Nikki and I did a version of ModelUN that isn't necessarily as well known, though the New York Times did write about it like a decade ago called
And they Great. Left us out.
And they left us out. Damn shame. They talked about all these other schools, but they left the University of Texas out. But
yeah,
it's called Crisis. And oh gosh. Well, what would you say is the elevator pitch for Crisis, Nikki?
Fast-paced, less procedural debate. Like
yeah.
That's kind of like what I think of it at its sort of like, yeah, baseline sort of thing. It doesn't move at the same pace as regular ModelUN. And it's also generally, like now for the most part, you're not taking the roles of UN ambassadors or agencies or anything. It can go all over the place, which I think is kind of where you're maybe getting to.
Well, exactly, yes. Because like a big thing about Crisis is so you think of like ModelUN or speech or debate where, you know, everybody is a group of countries and they have to have a conversation. And at the end of it, they reach a resolution. And then that's the end.
Mm-hmm.
Where in
Good job. Crisis, everybody applaud. You,
yeah, everyone,
you
everyone,
the topic.
They literally clap at the
end.
And that's considered a successful committee. Where Crisis, I mean, there is that live update to it. Mm-hmm. Where, you know, the delegates, I almost called them players just to show the mindset I'm in. The delegates, if we're going to use the phrase in MUN, you know, they come up with resolutions or solutions. And then you as the crisis staffer have to come up to what are those ramifications and you're live reacting to them. It's kind of like almost ModelUN meets Dungeons and Dragons and you're the room of like dungeon masters.
Mm-hmm.
And so like that was my first interaction with dealing with kind of individuals and a so-called player base, right? Of kind of interactive storytelling, where how do you react to people? And there were so many times when we were doing Crisis, when we would feel like we were teeing up the perfect scenario for these delegates to react to. You know, let's say for instance, I think one of the ones we did, it was the Kosovo Civil War, and we teed up this perfect situation where, okay, this group of students, they're NATO, they're role-playing as a bunch of generals and politicians, and we're giving them this thing where if they vote accordingly and they make the right choice, a bunch of U.S. soldiers will show up on the scene and stop a village from being raided. and you think you've laid it out perfectly for them. You think you have given them every single piece of detail, and they go off and do the complete opposite thing. And you have to go react to them in live time. And like that, what that experience is there, besides, like I say, the Dungeons and Dragons experience, I mean, that's game design in a nutshell, where if you're a game designer, you know, you're creating these puzzles, you're creating these mechanics in your game, and you feel like it's painstakingly obvious. This is how you solve this puzzle in a level. And the player walks the wrong way. And they think, oh, this is a showstopper. I can't get past it. And you're infuriated with them. But you have to take that feedback and you have to go funnel it back in. And it's like that kind of problem solving that makes games like an iterative development, which again, you know, when you compare to other industries, you don't have that in film. Mm-hmm. I mean, yeah, you have like test audiences and whatnot.
Yeah, not quite the same.
Yeah, yeah. But it's like,
almost more like stand-up.
That's a great comparison. Yeah, where it's you're having to live do stuff, where if you're not putting play testers in front of your game throughout development, you're going to release something that has a lot of missing pieces because you as a developer get to know it really well. Just like you as a Mob UN crisis guy or crisis director, if we're going to use the terminology, like you think you know it really well, someone's going to pivot on it differently. And again, that's like what goes to a producer. A producer's job is like, how do you take that feedback and you funnel it to the developers to find the solution that works for your player base? And I just like, I love that challenge. And so I was like, I want to do that professionally, and I want to make something that people care about that has legitimate feedback driven decisions to make it a product that is universally, maybe not universally loved. You can never achieve that, but at least where the player base is universally listened to, you know, and you at least try your best to give them what they want.
Right. Yeah. I love that you bring up Model UN because it's very similar to my experience as a writer, because when we think about crisis directing, right? I never patented this, but it's what I consider my sine graph of crisis directing, right? And so if you're a math head, you might remember what a sine graph looks like. It's sort of the big wavy up and down. And when I was explaining crisis committees to people and using that graph and being like, okay, every time it hits the x-axis, every time the line hits, that's a point at which you do something, right? Like you say, okay, this happens, this happens, this happens. And then every peak and trough at, you know, below and above the x-axis, that is delegate free space to do what they do. Mm-hmm. So like that's always how I sort of pictured it. Just that back and forth, up and down, and you as a director are just hitting that x-axis, keeping it sort of on track, but also giving them the room to play. And when I thought about that, I was like, that it feels very similar to screenwriting. And you think of the delegates as players, whereas I kind of think of them as actors. And it's sort of like becomes that collaboration, whether they kind of know it or not. You know, it's sort of like, as a writer, I'm just making sure we hit that x-axis right now and developing plot for people, for then the actors to then sort of define it how they want to. You know, the roles have, you know, positions that we encourage them to not totally ignore, but there is a lot of room for the delegates to sort of express their own personalities through it as well. And I think that's a very fun, like, collaborative thing. And it sort of works the same, I guess, between something like Model UN and having that relationship with your audience and your player base. I think it's like super fascinating. Again, that this kind of random thing we did in college, like, sort of provided the blueprint for like how we now like perceive these new careers we've started chasing.
Oh, and, yeah. It's fascinating to see like what other friends of ours have ended up doing. Yeah. When you take this into consideration, like, we know a guy and he's a roller coaster designer.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and just seeing like, I'd be curious what maybe his take isn't as like
maybe I'll get him on.
But that'd be really interesting. He'd be a great guest for this because he's done some really cool stuff. But I think he's, you know, a cool example of like what is creative storytelling, and when you have a specific audience in mind, his case being like the people who go to amusement parks, how do you subvert expectations and when you hit a drop or something?
Just to like cement, our friend is legit. He just got a job at Universal Studios Hollywood. So like he's not playing around at, you know, your Sunday fair.
No, yeah, this is our carny friend who puts up those little dinky roller coasters in the parking lot. Probably the most legit of all of us is the
world. I think he was the one that you can point to and be like, oh yeah, he made it.
Mm-hmm.
I think some of us still in progress. But that'll be a fascinating episode, and maybe we'll try and line that up. Where did you want to go by bringing that up?
Oh yeah, just with the whole idea of like how Model UN has affected us all.
Oh yeah.
And you know, it's like I'd be curious if he had something, and there's other people out there too, but it's just interesting. Yeah. And you know, I think it just, there's even sort of a meta point to that you can stem from one particular trunk on a tree and where people try to branch out with it. And again, why do I like games? Games, especially with bigger and better technologies out there, you can make games very creative with what you can pull off with that. You know, different narrative paths or different character builds, different narrative directions, et cetera.
Right. And yeah, I think this is also, I guess, a hybrid Model UN episode, but just considering how we also in Model UN in crisis took leadership positions, and we had to kind of have that ability to see the big picture and make sure people are doing their jobs and making sure that, you know, committees are running well. You know, that was a huge part of what we did. And, you know, you have people who are great to work with. You have people who are not great to work with. You have people who work fast, people who work slow. And you sort of have to mush it all together into one weekend where it runs perfectly. That's the thing. It generally ran perfectly. We were the golden generation. Kids now get on our level. I think that said, that makes me sort of like extra fascinated that you've gone into this producer side, right? It's almost like being the USG of Asuria's Embers, right? It's being able to look at all the various departments and wrangling them all together. And I guess like, How hard was that for you in this new field? Because it's like, it's obviously something you had to spend a lot of time first learning all the different pieces. I assume you have to have a good understanding of coding, of art design, of, you know, even if you don't do it, you have to understand it so that the teams under you can do their best work. So yeah, I guess like, how did you find that in terms of the challenge?
Yeah, no, it's definitely one of the more enthralling parts of the job, so to speak, because like what you'll often hear is a producer is the worst programmer, the worst designer, and the worst artist, but they know how to open every application.
Mm-hmm.
Because you do have to have that base level. You have to know what those pipelines are. And getting used to the velocities of different developers, I'd say, is really quite challenging. And it's not just like, okay, this individual on the AI programming team is able to knock out these tasks within a week, and this person, it takes 2 weeks. You have it where, okay, well, this person, they need things really drawn out for them. They need, you know, let's say you were talking artists, and it's, okay, we need a character who is a giant mutated toad man. That's one of the enemies in Asuria's Embers. So some artists, you know, they can just see the task written like, okay, model toad enemy. And they know what all those steps are. And they have a good enough relationship that you as a producer manage between the art lead and the artist to know, okay, when you consider all of these small steps, this is going to take this individual 3 or 4 days. That's fine. Other individuals, though, in order to understand their velocities, either because you don't have a working history with them, or maybe there's something like a language barrier and you just need to have those steps broken down a bit more because English is a second language for them.
Mm-hmm.
Or, you know, maybe they come from culturally a different type of work environment. You need to, like, say, okay, let me break down those tasks a bit further. So when do I have my low poly model is going to take me a day? And then to do the UV unwrapping will take 2 days. The texturing will take a day. Animation rigging, so on and so forth. And you have to break that all up. So figuring out what's the right cadence to talk with each member of your development team, that's part of what you need to figure out. And like, again, you know, I have to be able to know what all of that means. And you know, I can do a little bit of 3D modeling. And like, I know how to boot up 3ds Max and Maya and ZBrush and do all that type of stuff because I need to be able to talk to artists and like at least know the struggle. They're going to out art me 10 times out of 10.
Right.
But at least like if they're saying, hey, I'm having this particular problem, they can tell me what that problem is. I'm not going to be the one to solve it, but I can bring the right people over and you can sort of limit the number of steps between this is the blocker in somebody's way and how do you go across it? And then once you start to deal with cross-functional teams or interdisciplinary teams, that's when, you know, the coordination challenge gets even trickier because like you have artists who are delivering at this particular speed and you have software developers who are delivering at this particular speed. You know, like say, for instance, we have in Asurias, we had level designers who planned out, I think when it all was said and done, they had 5 or 6 different enemy types in mind.
Mm-hmm.
But ultimately, that rests on the art pipeline to make, model, and rig those characters in the animation, or pardon me, the SD pipeline, the software developer pipeline, to make them all functional. And regardless of how big the design is, like you only have so much time you can get this thing out the door. And when you look at what can the SDs accomplish, what can the artists accomplish? Realistically, we can only get maybe 3 enemies out or 4 enemies out. And you have to have those conversations. And you have to go back to the design team and you have to placate the people who put in all of the time and effort to build up a particular enemy type, you know, mm-hmm. on paper and say, hey, it's not going to get in here. You only going to work with this more limited enemy set. So that means you have to redesign this encounter. And so that's a whole back and forth talking too. So,
yeah. No, I mean, it's such a cool thing, I think, to be able to see all the moving parts. And I think that's why it's like those positions, they are as challenging as they are. There is something like incredibly gratifying about it. And I think, I guess, like, sort of out of curiosity, I was just wondering, not to make you put yourself down, but was there like one sort of department that you found the most challenging to either sort of like get your head around or try to understand, or you know, anything that was like it felt like you really had to dig deep to get around that?
Yeah, for sure. So I'd say out of like, you look at kind of the big three, which is design, programming, and art, everything is all broken down into subcategories from there. But you know, I would say at least in terms of cadence, I have the greatest learning curve with the programmers. I can do my fair share a bit of stuff in C#, which is the base level for engines such as Unity. But like you get to Unreal and that's C++, and I have next to no C++ knowledge. I can kind of do Blueprints, which is the visual scripting language in between. But when, you know, it's like my brain isn't wired to look at code and mm-hmm. see, oh yes, that's the problem. And so, but what's kind of nice is like, you get to work with your departmental leads. And so even though that was like personally the area that I think I could speak the least amount to, at least in terms of what's good code, what's bad code, I had a great relationship, still do have a great relationship with our lead software developer, Dylan. And, you know, he could translate things for me and vice versa in a way that we were able to get the programming team running really well. And we accomplished quite a number of really unique tasks there. And, you know, I can't speak to like how the animation programmer got the animations to feel the way he did in a way that is as deep and knowledgeable as if I was him. But I can speak to, well, here's the stuff that we overcame together. Here were the resources that I was able to hand to him. So even though I could never do that in a million years, you know, it's just kind of like a skill set you acquire with the ability to like get trust with the people you're working from. And, you know, what's most important is never assume you know anything. Yeah. Kind of like what they teach you in production, like kind of like the go-to line is, I don't know, let me find out, or let me get you the person who does.
Right.
You know, like that's what you're there for. The moment you start to assume a solution, especially if it's a solution you don't know, that's when things start to fall apart. And then you start to lose the trust of your team.
Yeah.
Where it's like, hey, I had a problem. I asked Reed to help me with it. He tried. He spoke confidently about his try, and it didn't help. Why should I ask him for help again? And then once you start to lose that trust, things start to slip through. And thankfully, that never really happened on our game. I mean, we had our fair share of issues. We had some problems whose solves. I think we didn't really get to the stage that we had in mind. But at least the entire time, we did feel a sense of camaraderie and, like, let's try to work on this together as best we can. And we kind of know who the subject matter experts are, and let's just try to clear the way so that subject matter experts can touch upon the things that they can without getting too in the weeds on something that they can't.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I love that you brought that up as the sort of mantra, because I think that really does apply like throughout your whole life, right? Mm-hmm. Like it's such a like good basic principle, especially in like creative circumstances, or of course circumstances where there's a lot of consequences. You know, it's such a great attitude to have. And speaking of not really exactly big consequences, when I worked in retail, that was also my, you know, similarly one of my favorite things about my position, because I always said I worked at Lego, and you know, the lowest level people are called brick specialists. And I would always tell people, I was like, the superpower of the brick specialist is that we can say, I don't know, let me find out. And it gets you out of all the, like, you know, you don't have to get to that point of where you're making something up and you're sort of fumbling your way through just to get this customer to not bother you or not get mad at you or whatever. And it just erases all that. It's like, I don't know, let me ask if the supervisor knows. Uh-huh. I'll get back to you. And it's such a simple thing that I think people maybe like have at some point tried to train out of themselves. I think we live in such a like, mm-hmm. I must sound like an expert sort of like social economy. I don't know if that's a social media thing where it's like you always have to have a take on something.
I think it's got to be, right?
Yeah.
It feels influenced in some degree that you are the most unique take on a thing. You have the most unique observation.
Yeah, it's almost like how, you know, how has not like every aspect of our lives not been, you know, touched by social media. But yeah, I think it's something to do with that, where it's like, yeah, like I'm not allowed to not know. Or at least I have to put up this front about, oh yeah, I know. And yeah, I think it really is just such a good attitude to have. I think, you know, it's something I appreciate really when I watch Jon Favreau, because I mean, this guy, we all know him, we, you know, creator, producer, writer, Mandalorian, Iron Man, you know, he kickstarted the MCU, largely successful Jungle Book movie, you know, we all know what he's done. And he really does have, he's at a stage in his life and career where he can just be like, look, I'm the boss. We're going to do it this way.
Listen.
But when you watch behind the scenes stuff, and especially the chef show, he is the most curious person I've ever seen.
Oh,
he's
God. Yeah.
Always asking, did I do this right? Show me that again. Is this the proper way? Why do we do that? And it's like, it's literally one of the best things in a creative capacity. It's like the movie chef will, first of all, like, open your soul. but the chef show, it's like, funnily enough, it's like when I feel like I need inspiration, I don't watch The Mandalorian. I watch The Chef Show. Like, that is where I feel like I'm seeing an artist, you know, be able to say, oh, huh, okay, cool. That's different. That's something I don't know. Let me understand that better so that I know why an expert does it that way.
Oh, 10,000%. And I think, you know, we talk about, you know, the downfalls of social media, but, you know, one thing that's so great about our interconnected society and our, you know, increasingly smaller world is the fact that we get to interact with way more cultures than before. And that's such a cool thing, right? Because just the way people think about things is different. And you're no longer operating in like the mindset of here's like the Western creative thought. Like for Asurias, one thing that was really important to us is that we were a really multicultural team.
Mm-hmm.
It was a team of 24 developers. We represented 6 nations. The majority of developers were not American. A lot of instances of English being a second language. And so what was important to us is that our game reflects this multicultural element. So like the reason we put it in the Himalayas as our setting was because a lot of our team came from India and China. And so we wanted to have like a game that reflected that multicultural element. And it was like really cool because like, I think I had a few moments where I was kind of like, oh, that humanities, liberal arts, social sciences, white guy nerd. We're like, I can speak to the state of Himalayan politics and history, but like I was immediately shut down. Like I had a like check yourself moment here. It's like, hey, you know, there's people who like that's their backyard and have been there getting to work with them and like, okay, are we portraying, you know, the art style in a way that's accurate? Are we showing respect to the myths that inspire the game? Are we showing respect to even like the animals that we have? And like one thing that was so cool about this game, you know, it's like really an awesome part of working with this game in a university setting is that we got to work with the anthropology department on the SMU campus to be sort of a cultural sensitivity consultant to make sure like, okay, you know, we have one of our levels takes place in a temple. How can we have combat in a sacred site in a way that is not offensive to people, in a way that's respectful? And so that's why, like, when you play the game, you'll notice you never actually go inside any of the buildings. You are exclusively outside the buildings because to take that into a building would be sacrilegious to some communities.
Right.
And when we were determining, like, the enemy types, they're all mutated animals because our game has this underlying environmentalist message. But we had to be careful which animals we put in the game because certain animals are considered sacred. And it was just like a learning experience the whole time too. Like I got to learn more about Nepal, about Bhutan, about the Himalayan ecosystem in a way that I would have never had I just made another game that is, oh, here's your typical Western FPS where you're playing as a 30-something brown-haired white guy fighting aliens. Which, to be fair, there's a lot of very good games that do that, but that's the point. There are tons of games that already do it. Let's break the envelope a bit. Let's break out of our comfort zones and learn something new. And I also thought, like, as a lover of history, what a cool way to learn history and culture by the visuals of seeing it in visual research and then seeing our artists bring that to life. Like, I feel like I left knowing so much more about a culture I had not given much thought to previously.
Yeah, definitely. I think that's a good sort of opportunity to dig a little deeper into the game. So I guess it's like, what would you, if there's a, you know, an audience member here and you're going to ask them to play this game, in your words, as one of the producers, how would you sort of try to sell it? What do you think is special, stands out about the gameplay? We know about sort of the historical cultural context a little now, but what do you think are some more like, this is why we believe in this game and you should play it?
Yeah, so besides the point previously alluded to, what makes Asurias Ember stands out is it's not just another first-person shooter. And it's also not that it's a bow and arrow mechanic, which is more rare than your classic gun mechanic. But what was important to us was to put this underlying gameplay element that sort of twists safety and the concepts of safety on its head. And so oftentimes when you play games, areas that are well lit, areas that have warm coloration like yellows and orange, that equals safety. When you're navigating through a map, you want to go to those safe zones. Those are the zones where you can save, or there's a bunch of potions or health packs or something. Our game flips that on the head. You want to spend most of your time in the shadows, because the way the entire narrative of the game goes is that you are living in a land of eternal daylight. There is an angry sun deity who has scorched lands. So rather than going out in the light, the longer you are out in the light, there's an environmental exposure mechanic where you start to take health damage. And so the game has this very calculated pace as you go from shadow to shadowed area, trying to bring these enemies into the shadows with you, where they're weaker in the shadows versus out in the sun. So it's not just like a run and gun shooter. It's not just an arena style. It's trying to find this very careful balance. One thing you'll hear often in the FPS community is, are you on your toes or on your heels? So like, for instance, like an on your toes shooter would be like Doom, Halo, you're running and charging. On your heels, that's more of like a sniper approach. Certain elements, like I'd say Far Cry, kind of to an extent, certainly Far Cry.
Like a Ghost Recon or something.
Ghost Recon, a lot of the Clancy ones, things like that. Or some of the shooters I'd say like are more realistic shooters, like Brother in Arms versus like Call of Duty, you know, where you have to be more careful. And so we do have some on your heels elements with you have to be in the shadow, while at the same time, let's keep it fast paced, because all of our combat arenas are Doom inspired. They do have that kind of on your toes. So finding that nice balance, I think our combat designers did a really good job finding that balance within a relatively short time. We were super lucky because our game development, we did have kind of an unofficial partnership with id, that's the developers of Doom, of Quake, Wolfenstein, who did give combat advice to help us find that. And they did play different versions of our build as we hit different milestones. And then the game feel, I think we can attribute a lot to some work that we did with Sony Santa Monica Studios. That's the studios behind God of War, making sure that how do we have animations that can really draw the player in, especially with a bow, because a bow and arrow game is very difficult to execute in first person, because you think about what sells archery. You look at the great archery games like Horizon or Legend of Zelda, and or even like the Assassin's Creed, you see the player pulling back the bow and you see their body posture change. Their shoulder going back, their elbow pulling back. You can see that strain. The moment you go into first person, you lose all of that. And when you're dealing with the tricky situation of, okay, well, we're supposed to stay in the shadows. That's the safe zone. We're not in the sunlight often. You're not even seeing the player character's shadow all that frequently. If you're seeing the player character's shadow, that means you're out in the sunlight. You're in danger. So you have to sell all of that within the animation frame of how you're holding the bow. And we actually got a lot of inspiration from Destiny. Destiny 2 has some lovely bow work. It is cool because SMS, as a member of the Sony family, does have some insights to other Sony studios such as Bungie, and like, I'll particularly check out these ones here, and the developers are very proud of that. And so, you know, we spent hours looking at Destiny's bow and arrow mechanics and Far Cry's bow and arrow mechanics, see how do we sell that in that limited frame space. So I'd say like that plus the light and shadow makes it a unique game that isn't just your go-to run and gun shooter.
I think it definitely shows. It's like the Destiny 2 bow combat is something I'm very accustomed to. That's a game I've, you know, put a lot of hours in. I know sort of a lot of the different kinds of bows and how they are unique and special. And I think that's really evident in a lot of how you guys did the, the mechanics for your game, because we're not going to pretend it has the same polish as a Bungie.
Oh, no, a thousand.
Of course. Yeah. Of course not. But like, it felt similar. Like, it didn't feel foreign. It was something where I was like, oh, I've done this. Like, I know what I'm doing. And while there are, little sort of, intricacies to either one that, you know, differentiate them, I think it really captured the same sort of feeling. And something else that I love about what you guys did was you create like a sort of an arrow armory of different kinds of abilities. And I guess that's something I'd love to hear more about, and why you specifically picked the ones you did in terms of arrow variants to provide different, you know, combat scenarios. And so, like, were they, like, how much was it, that's just cool? How much of it was, this will help you in this specific situation, we want to encourage you to have these kind of experiences? Like, what were all the, like, sort of things that went into the pot when it came to sort of designing your four arrow types?
Yeah, that's a great question. So the four arrow types that Nikki's referencing is, we kind of have our basic arrow, which has unlimited ammo. We operate kind of in a magical scene or a magical environment, because that was one of the things we had to consider. Do we ever leave the player in a situation where they can't shoot? And in most first-person shooters, like, that's what the pistol is for. You have some sort of infinite ammo pistol thing.
Mm-hmm.
And so let's have that with bows. And rather than just be, okay, do we do the Legolas Lord of the Rings trick where you're pulling out of your quiver that seemingly is never endless, or you're pulling it out of players, or you're collecting them along the way, or do we just have it magically manifest? And so the visualization for that arrow actually came... It was our lead SD, Dylan, was the one who planted this inspiration. I believe the movie's name is Legend.
Okay.
With Henry Cavill. And the way that he shoots arrows is he sort of manifests this golden bow out of nowhere. And actually, Destiny does the same thing as well, with how it's kind of more like energy orbs. So that was sort of our base level for that one. And then for the other three, we wanted to prioritize early in development, so during the prototype stage, let's figure out what these arrows are. And so our level designers under the direction of our game designer, Emily, who's utterly brilliant, and our lead level designer, Shaw, equally brilliant, they worked on making the phrase that you hear often in game dev is zoos, where you just kind of play around with different metrics. And so they worked with our LDs to build out kind of this playground of different columns, like how far can you shoot the arrow? How deep can it go? And then that went over to the SDs, where they tried different mechanics to see what looks fun by just putting out a bunch of different like blocks, saying, well, let's shoot the arrow and see how these blocks react to it and what is a cool look. And so we looked at first-person shooters and did some competitive analysis of what type of guns did people have and what's the arrow equivalent. So like a very common like gun that you see is a shotgun. So what is the shotgun for us? That's our scatter arrow. That's the second or the first specialty arrow, the second overall arrow you pick up. And all the other ones except the basic arrow, you do have limited ammo that you pick up throughout the map, and it unlocks as you progress. So the shotgun, that shoots multiple arrows at once. It has about like a third of the range distance-wise as the main arrow, but it deals a lot of damage, and it's used shooting multiple arrows. That's the scatter. So that covers that one. Then we wanted a kind of like a cool sort of, it's kind of like a bazooka type weapon, and that's our exploding arrow. So that's kind of your AOE, right? So you shoot this explosion, and it can take out... 1 to 3 enemies within a given radius, or, you know, it obviously deals more damage to kind of our larger enemies that we have in the game, so the boss enemies. And plus, it's just so satisfying. We got a really great explosion effect and explosion sound early, and we tested that early with players so they can feel that, okay, that's badass. That's awesome. And then the black hole is, interestingly enough, I feel bad. I want to give credit to whoever first thought of it. I don't know if it was just the team as a whole, if it grew organically or a single dev, but we wanted something that just kind of had a fun visual. And ultimately we didn't get the visual that we had in mind at first, which was for this black hole to shoot out, pick up enemies and then thrust them away. That's required a whole physics system that we didn't have time to develop. You can we do it with rocks, and that's what sold it. We showed it to our stakeholders, where you shoot the black hole arrow at all these cubes in our little playground, and they all go up and push away, and it looked so awesome. We're like, let's do it with enemies. And unfortunately, like I said, dev time didn't go, but we kept the visual, we kept the swooping sound effect, and instead what it does is it pulls enemies in and just kind of gradually takes down their health. And so that was kind of a cool magical one that also had sort of a sci-fi element as well. Not to mention the fact that since our game is so solar influenced, that something about a black hole would kind of match that. But it's really interesting. Like a couple of the other arrows that we looked at, one was a retrieval arrow where you like grappling hook, shoot and pull somebody there. It just early tests didn't work for that. And another was a grappling hook for the player where maybe we could do navigation puzzles. The difficulty with that is navigation puzzles in first person are really hard because you can't really see where you are. And so all of our navigation puzzles in our game that ultimately shipped are much simpler than the ones originally designed because it's difficult to see your feet. Like exactly platforming, you know, he's like, did I make the jump? I did not.
It's one of my favorite aspects of Destiny again, because it's like within a lot of the raids and dungeons, there's usually some kind of jumping puzzle. And it's always the one that like frustrates the most amount of people probably. Because they're always, it's always like, did I judge that right? And you inevitably didn't. And you go falling to your death. And it's like, it is just some, one of the, I always find them fun. So I say like a good challenge of the first person.
When you successfully hit it, it feels awesome.
It's such a like fun aspect of, especially that first person point of view. That's such a cool thing, thinking about all the different arrows. I'm sure there's like probably whole spreadsheets of possibilities, you know, like, oh, this could be this. I think if I remember correctly, was the black hole effect something an enemy does to you first and then
that's what we were proud of, and the explosion as well. So the explosion, before you pick up the explosion arrow, you run into this enemy that we eternally called the Abyssal. It's a reference to a particular mythical creature. It's never called that by name. It's kind of like an exploding beetle. It's modeled after the bombardier beetle that you can find around the world. It has kind of like a blowing up butt, which is kind of funny. Anyhow, so this beetle runs into you and blows up. You get used to getting blown up a few times. When you beat the level, the beetle's in there, you unlock the exploding arrow, and you feel like I gained his power. That's like our very own hero's journey, right? Is you gain the power of the enemies who you take down as you try to solve this crisis of your world is on fire, your world is dried out. And then the black hole arrow you run into, you acquire when you meet the big the boss in level 2. It is kind of funny that this boss is like a giant mutated pangolin. There's nothing like inherently black hole about a pangolin other than that they burrow. But that was kind of the humor in the moment. You're fighting this guy. He shoots a black hole. He brings you in and you can't leave it. And you get frustrated. Once you beat him, you get that power that you get to use. And so that's the whole scaling element. That's what makes for good level progression. And, you know, I think the first game to do that really well, and that was kind of our inspiration, is the man, right?
Okay, yeah.
Yeah, like as you beat the different robots, you get their abilities. And you have to beat other robots to get abilities to advance through the game. Otherwise, you'll get stuck.
Right. Yeah, no, just as a player, I really like that aspect in that having it done to you first. When you get it, you're like, oh, I know what this can do. And I know why it will lower, you know, I know like what kind of situation I would use that in, because, you know, as you watch your own health bar go down, you know what a lot of those things do first. So I think it adds like this element of payback time, you know,
for sure.
It's almost like this extra layer of going nuts on it. I guess we'll sort of wrap this up a little bit. We'll finish on some more sort of video game stuff, but I did just want to reiterate Asuria's Embers releasing on Steam, March 6th, Wednesday. Again, you're already listening to this, or listening to this now. It's already out. So that's on Steam, right? And it's free to play, free to download.
Yes, it's free to play. And one thing that was great about having the free to play model is, you know, we aren't trying to bring in a bunch of dollars, right? Mm-hmm. And when you don't have that pressure, that gives the developers times to, or not time, but just like the freedom to explore and to make mistakes. It was a great learning opportunity for everybody. You know, early in development, like I asked everybody, what's something that you either know how to do and want to get better at, or you don't know how to do and you want to have the experience to learn? And from there, that's how we figured out staffing. Mm-hmm. And it was really impressive to see everyone's growth and what they were able to accomplish in a relatively short time frame within that learning thing. And yeah, I look forward to it being out in the world for people to play and fingers crossed, hopefully enjoy.
Yeah. I mean, that's actually another thing I wanted to ask. How long was the development process? Uh-huh. Just to give people sort of an idea of how much time you guys put into this to give that final version.
Yeah, so we worked on it 5 days a week for 3 hours every day from the middle of August until the first week of December. So that's really not that much time. That's just a handful. It's 2 full months and some half months. We had a month and a half of pre-production in the summer prior to going to full development in August, but it was a very rapid iterative cycle. We had milestones that were every other week. So that was deliverables that we had to hit within a very tight time frame. That's feedback that we had to take and execute very quickly. And that's a lot of stuff we had to cut along the way. But I'm really proud of what we accomplished in relatively limited working hours. And the fact that we made sacrifices that didn't take away from the game's feel. And I think it's a great preview of everybody's abilities. And I look forward to seeing, you know, where the team that built it ultimately ends up. You know, everybody's in the process of kind of finding out their next steps in their career. And I think there's some really talented folks who I had the privilege to work with, and I hope they land at some cool studios. Would be very lucky to have them on their teams.
That's a great thing to mention, because that's sort of kind of where I want to go next in terms of just not only what you're up to, but just video games in general. We are, you know, both of us experiencing a time where the entertainment industry is pretty turbulent. You know, there's a lot of well-documented, you know, examples in recent months, especially in the video game world, of sort of mass layoffs. It's sort of like impossible to escape the conversation of like how much AI will take someone's role away, you know, all these various aspects that are in this creative field. And I guess like that's sort of, you know, for as a writer, I feel like, you know, oh, I have a promising pathway, but it does also feel like, you know, the outside world is desperately trying to make you redundant. You know, like there's almost that feel too. So it's like, I guess, you know, being on the brink of, you know, graduating from your program and stepping into that full, you know, industry world, I guess what are the kind of things that are, you know, not necessarily keeping you up at night, but like you just sort of identify them as, you know, this block, this challenge, this kind of unknown, like what do you perceive as being like the biggest ones?
Yeah, you know, the situation with the layoffs is of course dreadfully unfortunate. There are a lot of really talented people out there with a lot of experience who, you know, they're at the wrong end. A lot of decisions were made, whether either rushed or not, to really bloat the industry with a lot of roles. And the industry is reacting by condensing. And I think what you see in the gaming industry is it's very, very trends focused. I think all entertainment industries are trends focused, whether you have...
Always reactionary.
Right? 1,000%. Yeah. Whether it's on the design side, which is like, oh, Witcher 3, what a great open world game. We're all going to try to make an open world game.
Yeah, you know, whether make it's your that, Witcher 3.
Exactly. Or you like make the World of Warcraft killer. How many MMOs out there tried to clone World of Warcraft? It's just a well-known fact out there that if you're entering that space, you want to try to mimic them and do what they did. That just happens. And that happens on the business side of things too. Your competitors start hiring, you're going to start hiring. Your competitors start greenlighting projects, you're going to start greenlighting a lot of projects. And people rushed into that in ways that maybe they didn't think out clearly. And then you have kind of the whole ebb and flow. Companies start laying off. If you're a company and maybe it's kind of tight and you feel like you're a little bloated, you feel like, okay, well, if this company's laying off, I can get away with layoffs too.
Yeah,
I'm going to go ahead. These layoffs, I may never have happened, or they may have happened in 6 months, but I'm going to go ahead and do it when everybody else is there. And the industry will kind of go at the same time. But like, the industry is in a perfectly fine state of health. I mean, you see how well these games are doing. This is not 1985, where on the verge of a crash. This is just the employment situation is not, if there's not a careful calculus behind it, and ultimately a lot of people are being harmed.
Right. I think, like, you know, you mentioned sort of like the rationale, sort of the people who make these calls kind of go through. And I think that is kind of like one of the scary things, because it's like, it's not just underperforming studios, right? I think one of the big ones recently was Insomniac, who, you know, has done these Spider-Man games for Sony, which have, you know, by every metric succeeded, right? Like, I think they've pushed, like, you know, the sales numbers for Sony, like, you know, it's their highest thing. And even Insomniac, who delivers that much for the company, had to make those cuts, right? So it's almost like, yeah, like there's not that feeling of we did a good job, so we're safe.
Yeah. And I think... So in the short term, I certainly have a lot of trepidation. It's less so worry about like finding work in the industry, but more that currently you have a talent pool that's really large and everything is just moving so much slower, because when previously maybe you had one position and you could fill that position with a decently qualified candidate within a relatively short amount of time, even just like what recruiters and hiring managers have to go through, there's so many more resumes they have to sift through and so many more cover letters and recommendations to try to find the right person. And it's really easy to fall through the cracks because you're just one person in just a horde of available talent. And so that's what's kind of scary. And that just makes everything go a little slower than anticipated. Certainly if you're someone who either is, you know, graduations coming up, or you were just recently laid off, and things like that. And then, you know, the next thing, it's like, oh, if I do get hired, what if I get hired on a project that's canceled? Or what if I get hired on a project that, like you said, no matter how well it does, there's not guarantee that I'll stick around. But, you know, I think ultimately there's some interesting trends going on that in the long term, I feel like the industry will be better to its employees. At least I hope. I think we're going to see more mid-sized studios showing up, especially when you have a lot of studios that are spinning back out on their own, like Toys for Bob, the Spyro studio leaving Activision, Saber Interactive leaving Embracer Group and successfully buying themselves back out there. I think if you have that, and as well as a little bit of funding towards kind of the smaller studios to sort of size up a bit, but not too much, you'll find kind of a really interesting creative balance. And then, you know, hopefully, I mean, you can just open LinkedIn and see people talk, or you can just read the chatter that more rights for game workers, it's brewing. And I think a lot of people are afraid to take that first step. But, you know, whatever is the group of people that do, you know, all the power to them, you know, and trying to make things better for everybody. And I think, you know, when you have happy developers, you've got high quality products, you have high quality product, you have happy customers, and you know,
right,
that's the business case for it, right? You want everybody happy and spending money if you want to get it reduced to that.
Yeah. excited, wanting sequels, you know, all that stuff, right?
All of that stuff, yeah. All that monetization.
Yep. Get Asuria's Embers 2 out there.
Oh, yeah. this one won't be free. I think
it's an interesting thing, because I think sort of similar can be pointed to in film land, where you're sort of seeing the rise of, like, you know, A24 is a very popular one, Neon, you know, like these studios who are not your mega people, right? And you're seeing more and more real quality come. I think that's, like, one of the beauties of A24, where it's like they didn't take many things on, but, like, their first few were, you know, quality. And, you know, they sort of build that reputation of quality. And it's interesting to see, again, like, yeah, these smaller ones sort of, you know, take their steps forward in, you know, maybe taking from Netflix or, you know, Disney, Universal, you name it. Yeah, it's a really, like, just like, it's a strange landscape, but I think it's one of those things where it's like you kind of, you have to maintain that sort of, like, ignorance of optimism, right? Like, yeah, because if you get too negative about it, like, you will kind of stop yourself, right? It's one of those things where you kind of just have to put up the blinders and put your head down. And like, keep going, keep trucking through. So, yeah, I think, you know, a lot of people who are listening to this, probably because they're listeners or friends of the Imperial Senate podcast, which, of course, is Star Wars, and which, of course, Star Wars has a lot of video games, past, present, future. So people, I think, you know, as Star Wars fans, are pretty invested in, like, the gaming world. And, you know, whether that's playing Galaxy of Heroes or, you know, Battlefront, or Jedi Survivor, those kind of things, like, people tend to have an opinion about the video game industry, especially with the Star Wars games. But I guess I wanted to ask, what do you think is the biggest, like, misconception of the video game industry?
Oh, man. There's a lot of them.
Even if you don't want to place value, you can throw a few out there. You know?
Yeah, like one that I think is of note is that, you know, a lot of people have been sort of lamenting how much longer games take.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and feeling that, oh, you know, you had franchises where sequels could be coming out once every 2 to 3 years, and now it's 5 to 6. Or now it's you know, you look at how long between, like, GTA 5 and GTA 6, for instance, right? But the reason for that length is twofold. One, it's just, like, the technical and artistic quality of these games has gotten so much greater.
Mm-hmm.
And in order to pull that off takes a ton of work. And two, like, the working conditions. Mm-hmm. These games were coming out every few years because people were putting in 100 hours...
The crunch, right? That's the
it's the crunch. Yeah, they were doing crunch from day one to the end. Yeah,
it's just not sustainable.
That's not sustainable. Yeah. I'd rather have a game be delayed by, you know, a year than it having to kill the people working on it.
Yeah.
Now, hopefully, if you've done your, you know, product planning and production well, you don't have to get there because you've carefully figured out, okay, this is how long it's going to take to get these things. You have a good relationship with your publisher. And everything like that. But, you know, it's like games follow such a completely different lifespan and production schedule than compared to movies and TV. Mm-hmm. And I think a lot of people familiar with certain aspects of the entertainment industry try to project that onto games, not realizing how far off that is, because there's so many moving pieces. On the technology front, like, maybe you're making a game for a console that hasn't been released yet.
Mm-hmm.
That's a whole different development thing you have to deal with.
Because is it possible, like, you know, say you started development on something that was going to be a PS3 game, but, like, in your development time, it sort of, like, actually, we want to do this for PS4, Like, yeah, is that the kind of thing that happens?
Oh, that happens all the time.
Yeah.
And, you know, you'll see that's a big instance of, I think it happens less because also the console life cycle development is different than it was maybe 5 to 10 years ago. Plus, like with live service being a thing and day zero updates and all that type of stuff, you can better bake that in. And there's a lot more transparency. Like, no one is surprised by a console announcement, right? You have reps who are
Yeah.
giving you a heads up it's coming. But that's something that absolutely happened. Or, you know, if you want to do an engine change, you know, which you'll see that happen sometimes too, especially if you're a subsidiary, where let's say you built the first two games in a franchise on one engine and then you're bought. And your parent company says, we want all games that we publish made on this engine. You have to bake in all the time to relearn the engine, figure out what works and what doesn't. EA did this famously with Frostbite, which is the engine that made by DICE, and they wanted everyone to move on it. And BioWare wasn't prepared, and that led to a lot of hiccups for Dragon Age, a lot of hiccups for Anthem, so on and so forth. And
Oh,
so, you
poor
know, the
Anthem.
poor Anthem, it had such a great idea behind it.
I remember watching that like footage for the first time, being like, I will not ever stop playing this game.
Oh, it seemed too good to be true. And
Yeah.
there's a lot of back end stuff there, and it's they weren't ready. That was a great example of a thing being rushed.
Yeah.
But yeah, you know, I think, you know, people are really impatient. And that's also like why, going on the point on like different systems, you have whole companies whose sole job is console ports and development, where you have like a studio is the main developer on a game, but you'll have a studio for hire, a hired gun studio, so to speak, that does code development just for the like Nintendo Switch version of a game.
Yeah.
So you're sending them all your files so they can then release the game on Switch 5 or 6 months later. And there's just like all of these moving pieces, and like just the ecosystem is, I think, is so much larger than a lot of people realize, you know.
Okay.
And then like I think another big misconception people have about games is I think there's generally not much of an awareness of how much iterative design goes into it, you know, and
Right.
how kind of what we're talking, the whole like play testing thing, and how carefully that has to be executed. If they think it's just a package product, and like the design that you show up with on day one is so much more different than what you end up shipping, because you've given it to Kleenex testers, people who've never played before. You've given it to your stakeholders. You've given it to focus groups throughout every single stage. And that also makes things change.
Yeah, it seems very much like a case of, to put it in like sort of a writing standpoint, it's like when your team comes together and makes a thing and packages it, all you did was make the rough draft,
There's
right?
an
And it takes so much fine-tuning from that point at which you would maybe normally say, we did it, we finished. But like there's so much like tweaking and finding out if this, you know, maybe this whole scene doesn't even work. So it's like it's yeah, I think it's one of those things where it really does have to sort of, yeah, you have to understand that aspect of how much it's just sort of put through the filter, I guess, you know, so many times. And it's like I always think the same about video games in terms of, you know, delays and stuff. Obviously, you know, as a fan of something, as a fan of a studio, I don't like the idea that, you know, a game is delayed because of mistakes. Like, you know, obviously they happen, but it's not something I'm, of course, as a consumer, want to see happen. But generally, I think there's not very many examples that sort of go against the idea that you will get the better game
Yeah.
if the time frame they're given that extra time.
And
I
it's,
think it,
yeah, like keeping better, that doesn't necessarily mean it will be perfect. You know,
right.
sometimes projects are so off the rails that you can keep adding time. It may improve it, but there's things you can just never get to because there's so many mismanagement issues and design issues so early on that that you can never fully cross. But it's very rare that a delay happens and what you get from the delay is somehow worse than if you hadn't had the delay.
Right.
You know, it's
even with Halo Infinite.
Yeah, and it's like, I think what we're seeing more and more, which is so grateful for, is, you know, the whole live updates, games have the option. And I know this frustrates a lot of people, but games have the option to get better.
Mm-hmm.
To look at key performance indicators and telemetrics and be like, how can we make it better? And we can just live update it. And
yeah.
Put a patch out. You know, this, oh, people are putting out broken games. You know, you hear that one a lot.
And, mm-hmm.
Yeah.
It just has changed a lot, right?
Yeah, and the industry has changed where it's like, okay, we can either push this back or we can release it because we have consumers who will buy it.
Yeah.
And we know we can fix it. And mm-hmm. you have games that have successfully been able to fix it when they're so broken that as much like complaining as you see about certain games, if you play your cards right, you can buy that goodwill back. No Man's Sky, phenomenal example of that. Cyberpunk 2077, phenomenal example of that. I'd say Mass Effect Andromeda to a smaller extent, where it's like, hey, yeah, this didn't turn out the way we wanted, but you're all connected to the internet, so we can push this different version.
Yeah, I know that. I know that's kind of a feeling that happened with probably both Destiny 1 and 2, in terms of like the vanilla version came out, had a good, you know, first sort of 20 levels, and then once you sort of finish that, it's like, oh, what are we doing here? And then in their like next big release, like they were adored, right? It's like Taken King and Forsaken came out, and it's like, yeah, so it's one of those things, like, yeah, nothing's a miracle in the sense of like magic tricks. Like,
no,
you don't get a perfect thing necessarily. I know some of us lament the time where you can just go buy the disc, put the disc in, and that's the game, right? but also it is sort of it's a very interesting aspect of how we sort of make and consume them now, and that you can
absolutely
change them, right?
Yeah.
They can develop over time. I mean, God, how many times has Destiny changed since I've been playing it? Like, I was a day one-er on Destiny 1, and it's like the things that exist now, it's like, obviously that's a long time. That's like 10 years or so. But it's so different, even though it's still the same. You know, it's like, we still know it all, but yeah, I think we'll go ahead and close this one out. I think it's been a pretty good, pretty great, even first episode of the Yub Nub Club. Thank you so much, Reed, for coming and spending so much time talking about your projects, your industry, and you know, things that have gone on in this land, you know, this realm of entertainment. And I guess, is there anything in particular you'd like to plug, or, you know, tell people that you're looking for hiring? You know?
Yeah. So I told the right people I was going to promote this. So if you are interested in a career in game development, SMU Guildhall can help. So just please visit guildhall.smu.edu or contact guildhall@smu.edu for more information on how to kickstart your career in game development. There are three tracks you can focus on. Pardon me, four tracks you can focus on. Software development, art creation, level design, or my very own production. And if you ever want to reach out to me and ask any questions, I kind of am off Twitter and other social medias, but I'm going to be a dork and just say, reach out to me on LinkedIn, which is just my name. I'm the only one. So find me, shoot me a message there.
Keep it professional.
Yeah, you know, I try to keep professional. And if you can't find me that way because you don't like LinkedIn because you're too cool for it, that's fine. Just reach out to the ISP folks and they know how to get in touch with me and we'll find something. If for whatever reason you feel like I'm an incredibly interesting person and you're just dying to chat to me. I do love networking though and getting to meet people. So I'm open and available for a conversation, a text, a Discord chat. I'm just not going to share that one publicly.
Right. Yeah. You know, you never know what opportunity arrives when you open a certain door or window. So definitely get in touch with us, get in touch with Reed, however you feel is best. If this is this was a conversation that provoked a lot, provoked some, you know, some new thoughts for you or some new ideas. So I guess once again, thank you so much, Reed. Thank you very much for being the first guest on the UbNub Club. Thank you, of course, our dear audience, for spending this time with us. I hope you will come see us again and see what's up next. Thanks, everybody. We will see you next time.